So what is OPEC orientation? OPEC orientation, the essence there is to have instantiatable modules. A module was a package with routines and data declarations, but a module, as we have in Modula or Pascal or Ada, is not instantiatable. You cannot instantiate a module. Idea between object orientation is to have instantiatable modules. You can allocate a new module and call its methods on that module. So a module is then a class, right? So you can instantiate classes, and a class is a grouping of methods and declarations that belong together. Object orientation is not only just a programming model; it's also a sort of design, a way to design programs. Instead of with imperative program, you think about how to write the functions to make my program work. Right? With imperative programming, you're programming at a very low level. Design method. You program your methods, and you program until the application works. With object-oriented design, you think about what kind of data structures, what kind of data am I manipulating, and from those you infer what kind of methods you need. So imperative programming is code-oriented design, and object-oriented programming is data-oriented design. You identify the data. Then you define the structure of your, the architecture of your application, and then you, at the end, write your functions, your methods. So imperative programming, code first, data later. Object orientation, data first, code later. So this is the way of design. There are different ways of design, right? So languages that are more suited to design of infrastructure. We'll talk about those later. So the principle of object-oriented design is to encapsulate all the data together with the functions that operate on the data inside of a package, a class, and then the method should only operate on the internal state of the object. It should not be that that outside functions can directly manipulate the internals of your objects. That more or less violates the design of an object-oriented application. So operations should be the sole interface towards the internal state of the object. That gets towards more of an abstract data type. An abstract data type is one step towards object orientation. Object-oriented designs go a little further than ADTs by providing inheritance. You cannot have inheritance on ADTs, right? Because a derived class should be able to manipulate the internals of a state of the base class, and that you cannot do with an ADT. Right. Binding times with imperative functions, imperative methods. In imperative programming, you directly manipulate the functions. You directly access the functions, and you know exactly what is going on. With object orientation, binding is deferred until a later time. You call a method or an object, but it could be that it's the method of the base class or a method of the derived class. You don't know. That is something that decision, which actual method to invoke, happens sometimes later at runtime. And at runtime means dynamic. So dynamic means at runtime. For a language to be object oriented, what does it at least need? You need to have data encapsulation, some way to abstract away from your data, and to have operations on the data to abstractly manipulate that data, some form of inheritance. If you only have encapsulation without inheritance, you've programmed ADTs, right? So ADTs plus inheritance gives you objects. Then dynamic binding is optional, right? Dynamic binding means that at runtime we decide which actual method implementation to call. Then there are two alternatives. Either you have everything object-oriented, or you have some sort of hybrid imperative language, object-oriented language, such as C++ or Ada or Delphi. The problem with pure object-oriented languages is if everything is an object, then everything has also the overhead of being an object. And that means either in terms of memory or in terms of execution time. So, classes. This is some C++ code. In C++, unlike Java, you can separate the specification from implementation. Right, so the specification is what can the public see of my class and what is internal to my class. So protected means my derived class can access these members. Public means anything elsewhere can access my methods, and private means only this class can access these members. The implementation is then separated from your specification. So this is the .cc file and this is the .h file. So I can separate specification and implementation, and we already saw why that is a good idea. Then we have colon colon as a scope operator for accessing either namespaces in C++. So a namespace is the pendant to a module in Ada. So you have modules, or namespaces, and inside of modules or namespaces you have classes. Classes can have static fields, which are persistent across new and delete, just like you've seen it in Java. Overloading. We already saw overloading with imperative languages. So overloading is not restricted to object-oriented languages. Overloading can also be applied at object-oriented languages. It's also not an either-or. So here, I allocate an object, and then I can select either the first foo or the second foo based on the argument types. What C++ is doing is the rule of least conversions. Least conversions means how many type conversions do I need to apply to convert the argument type to the parameter type. These type conversions can also include object instantiations. For example, if I have an object, a method, if I have a method foo, which takes as an argument an A type, right? And I have a class A, with a constructor A, which takes an integer argument, int x. I should be able to call this function with an integer constant. This integer constant matches my the constructor of A, and therefore an A will be implicitly allocated, allocates an A, wraps the integer, and calls this foo. So this is allowed. So coercion, this is not just a pure matching. This matching can go one step beyond and also include conversion paths. Although in C++, the path can only be one length. It is never the case that if you have a class B, which takes an A as an argument. So for example, this does not work in C++. If you have a B here, and a class B, with a B, which takes an A as an argument, then it does not work. Can only have paths of one length. It never searches for all possible combinations of constructors to find a matching path towards a conversion. There are languages who try to do this, to find the complete paths through the entire constructor tree to find a possible coercion to match one argument to a parameter. C++ only does path of length one. Okay. Okay, so inheritance. Inheritance is where you extend the functionality of one class with some new functionality, or override some unneeded functionality with some better implementation. For example, I have a stack class, and we already saw that PostScript from last week was basically stack-based, that's like forth. So we can forth is or PostScript extends a stack class to inherit those methods. And an add in PostScript is push pop-pop. Right? This is just what we need. What happens in C++, however, is that polymorphism is optional. You need to opt in to get the polymorphism, because polymorphism costs. So what happens here? I allocate a postscriptor. Then stack s is equals p, so it's a pointer assignment. It's assignment compatible because, you know, a postscriptor is a stack, so the assign is allowed. Then I call the add method over s. That does not work because s does not have an add method. The stack does not have an add method. That's only a new method that I added in the postscriptor. Right? So there's no dynamic resolve of what kind of methods are actually implemented. It only looks at the static type to see what it's implemented. This is the same thing that happens in Java. Right? Java has the same semantics. Other languages do allow this to happen. So it's a dynamic lookup of what kind of methods are actually implemented in the class that you are pointing to. So not every language looks at classes as types. Right? Some languages look at classes as their own separate thing from the type system, where the type system only includes things like int and float, and classes are a separate type tree. Right. Before I go on, there are two ways of looking at inheritance over types. And it relates to their implementation. Some languages say that when you inherit from a class, you include whatever is inherited. Others say, whenever I inherit from a class, I take a reference to whatever my base class has. So either my derived class contains my base class, or derived base, or I have a derived class which takes a pointer to an object that for my base class. Right? So here the base class is contained in, or my derived class has a pointer to an instance of my base class. This is the implication that when I call a method here, if I call a method, it's either in my derived class or directly in my base class. Here, if I call a method, it's either in my derived class or I need to forward the call to my base class. Right? Not here, then forward it until somebody really implements it. This relates a little bit to polymorphic types. So a polymorphic type is a data type that can refer to different types at runtime. So it's the same what we already had with the stack and the postscriptor. I had an S pointer, which could either be a stack or a derived class. Right? So it's a polymorphic function. Polymorphic data type. A polymorphic function is then a function that can operate on different argument types. So if I have a function zoo, which has an S argument, an S pointer S, that can run on either a stack or a postscriptor class, right? That already works. So that is already a polymorphic function. Right, contracts. So the idea of a contract is basically a class without any data, so without any data declarations. And a contract is then what needs to be implemented by whoever implements it. So the implementer fulfills a contract. So how do I specify a contract? I need to specify a number of methods that should be implemented sometime later. So in C++, I name these are called pure virtual methods. So a function equals zero means there's no body, right? There's no code. That should come later. This is the same as in Java by writing the methods by noting the abstract as abstract. Right? So in Java, for example, you create an interface for a vehicle, and then a car needs to implement your contract. Interface. Right? So the goal of one of the goals of object orientation is code reuse. There are a number of goals for object orientation. One goal is a cleaner architecture of your application. Another goal is code reuse, where I write some code and some parts of my code can be reused by somebody else, by specific in, by applying specific inheritance. Right? So this class I can derive from, and that class I can derive from, and then do my application specific things. One of the problems of this is, how do I know that these base classes fulfill the contract? Right? I have some sort of contract that I expect from my methods in pre and post conditions. How do I know that my base class fulfills these pre and post conditions? What Eiffel is, for example, doing is programming by contract. Programming by contract means that every method has a number of pre and post conditions, and these pre and post conditions are either checked by a verifier or at runtime. So at runtime, these pre and post conditions are converted to if statements. Right. Another problem with object orientation is that object orientation allows you to override methods. It does not allow you to override fields. So if I have a base class with an integer x and an integer y and so forth, I cannot say in my derived class, I do not need this x field of the base class anymore. I cannot throw away data declarations of my base class. I can only override methods of my base class. Traits. So a trait is a partially fulfilled contract. So a contract was interface in Java or a class with pure virtual methods. If I then have some pure virtual methods and a few normal methods, then it's a trait. Some languages, such as Scala, have traits as a built-in type. So you can have these more formally seen in your code. So you know what is a contract and what is a class by just looking at the source code. Duck typing. Scripting languages, such as Python, also allow object orientation. But the essence of a scripting language is that you do not have to write any types. In a scripting language, you do not write your types. These types are inferred. The system decides what the types of variables should be. For example, here, I declare a class Y, and never do I say what the fields of this class are. Never do I say what the types of X and N are. These types are inferred. So whenever I have an assignment self.v, that means that self should have a field v. So whenever I do an assignment on an object, and this object does not have that field yet, then that field should be added to the class. So on the first assignment to an object, that field is dynamically instantiated. The same here, from self.h is none, that means that self should have an h field. And the type of that should be the none type. Right? And so forth. So this is duck typing. Right? The idea of duck typing is I write my class without any types, but as long as it behaves as a given data structure, then it must be of that data structure. So if it behaves like a list, it is a list. So dynamic binding, we already talked about dynamic binding a little bit. Dynamic binding is the process of, at runtime, finding out which method I should actually call for a given method invocation. So associating method invocations by actual implementations. Right. So here, same idea. I have a stack, and from that stack I derive a reverse stack. It's push and pop are reversed. Then take a pointer to the thing and then call pop. When for this pop, I really want the derived method called and not the stack call. But how do I then specify if I actually did want the pop of the base class and not of the derived class? In Java, you cannot really say this in one step. If you have a reference to a derived class, I cannot directly call the method of the base class, right? If the method was overwritten, I mean. So in C++, I have to specifically opt in for dynamic binding. So I have to, when I have a class with a few methods, I have to mark these methods with virtual to opt into dynamic dispatch. Right? And only then will, if I have this reverse stack, this derived pop be called if I have this reference assignment. Otherwise, I have the static name binding. With Smalltalk, Smalltalk always uses dynamic binding. It also uses dynamic lookup of methods. So if I have a reference to something, then at the runtime, it's checked if that method holds that specific method name. Right? So if that method is actually in the class. There's no runtime compile time checking whatsoever in Smalltalk. In Smalltalk, all the errors come when you try to execute the program. There's no compiler analysis to see if your program is incorrect. Everything happens at runtime. So it's extremely flexible, right? Because at a runtime, is it examined if a object actually implements a given method with a given name? So this is onward to reference semantics. All this polymorphism, all these polymorphic method names, method invocations, only work when you use pointers, or in other words, references. If you have if you use call by copy, or if all objects are passed by copy, then dynamic dispatch doesn't work. You need a pass by reference for dynamic dispatch to work at all. So this is the difference between imperative programming and it's another difference between imperative programming and object-oriented programming. If you pass an X to a method as an argument or to a function as an argument in object-oriented programming, a reference is passed as an argument. In imperative programming, the whole thing is passed by copy. Right? In C++, you can explicitly program both versions. Right? So if I have an ampersand there, that means passed by reference, this object. Otherwise, without the ampersand, it's a call by copy. This, of course, call by reference and call by copy have different semantics for what I can expect after a method call. Right? That's clear. So these reference semantics are problematic in C++ because you have to keep track of what is a reference, what is a copy. So here I have a class, and another class inherits from that class, then instantiate two copies on the stack of these two objects, call publish, it'll call the first publish, r.f, this assignment is, what does this assignment do? Either it gives no error, right? Because the size of r is equal to the size of f, so this memcopy would work, so I can easily copy these values to that copy, right? They are the same size, no problem. But what happens here when I call this r.publish later? Know that I requested virtual inheritance, right? I requested dynamic dispatch. This will still call report, even though it's dynamic dispatch. Right? This is tricky because what internally happens, internally in C++, every object has a small header that describes what kind of object this is. And by doing this assignment, I overwritten the administrative part of the object, including the virtual function table, the method table pointer. All right, shared references. So if I have objects, and objects are uninspectable by themselves, right? You cannot externally directly access the members of an object. I cannot poke around in the internals of a B or an A or a C, right? Then I can more easily reason about the relationship between objects, right? Objects are self-contained. They cannot be externally manipulated outside of their operations. In such languages where I can have, where objects are indeed self-contained and I cannot poke around in the internals, then it's easy to think about objects as object graphs. I have graphs of objects that live at runtime. If such a thing happens, then I have multiple objects that have an aliased B, so they share an object B in effect. Object management. Whenever I say new, I do not say where it should be allocated in memory, right? But however, for performance, it's better to have objects that are used together also be allocated together in memory, right? So what I want to have is when I allocate an object and then I allocate another, I have some sort of close to operator. So B should be close to A in memory of type Y. Some languages do this, where you have some C dialects, say C dialects, have this sort of locality annotations where you can say this should be close to that and get some performance. If you have some annotations such as this, it'll get you a performance increase of about at most 30%. But 30% is quite a lot still, right? For just adding an annotation, you get 30% performance. That's good news. Right. Another problem is if everything is an object, such as in Smalltalk, right? Every local variable is an object, every integer is an object, every constant is an object, then before you know it, you'll run out of memory. The problem is, if every object in, for example, if you use Java, every object has at least 16 bytes overhead, right? For C++, it's about 8 bytes, right? 8 bytes because you have an object allocation header, right? Instead of in front of every object. If every int is an object and int is 4 bytes, then you add 16 bytes overhead for a 4 byte payload. So that's a little much, right? So what Smalltalk compilers try to do, a little bit of an optimization, is getting rid of superfluous object headers and automatically try and go back towards making int only really an int and not an object to remove all these object-oriented overheads.
Slide before, you said that there's an 8-byte header for C++ files.
Yeah? No, it's a malloc header. And when you say new X, right, it internally calls malloc to allocate the data, and malloc has that much overhead because there's a previous pointer and next pointer.
So we don't see it
from the programmer. From a programmer, you see size of int and you see 4. But if you say new int, it's internally internal overhead there, right? Okay. So when do I use inheritance? And when do I just use something as a field of an object? If I have some sort of is a relationship, right, a FIFOQ is a Q, then it's inheritance. If it's something like have, or this has something else, then it's better to patch it into as a field of an object. So it's a clear clear way of looking at the design of an architecture of an application. So a car is a vehicle. But a car is also a taxable entity, right? The government can let you pay tax on your car. That means that a vehicle has a number of wheels, a taxable entity has amount of tax that you pay per year, and a car is both a vehicle and a taxable entity. Right? This is multiple inheritance. You inherit from multiple base classes. And then you have the sum of all the methods of your base classes to be implemented in your derived class. The problem is when methods with the same name are inheritable by multiple base classes. So I have a vehicle, it has a count, and a taxable entity also has a count. So both have a count method, and when I implement my car, then which ink count am I really overriding here? Am I overriding the ink from vehicle or the ink from taxable entity? In C++, you're overriding both. Right? So this implements both the derived methods, even though they are semantically different. The intention of the programmer of the base class was to have a semantically different base classes, of course. To get around this a little bit is by virtual inheritance in C++. in virtual inheritance, I merge conflicting members and keep only the keep only one. So I need to implement only one inc count, which will implement both of these paths. With explicit scoping, I can specify which of these base classes methods I actually wanted. In Eiffel, I need to rename members. In Perl and Python, there's a depth first search at runtime made to find the best matching method for a given method call. In Smalltalk, Java, Objective-C is only single inheritance, so this problem doesn't happen. So here's the same thing again, right? I have an entity. It's a base class, and text entity and person both inherit from entity. And a musician is both a person and a taxable entity. And then I add a foo method, which uses num instances. Num instances is inherited from both person and taxable entity. So there are two instances of this num instances field, right? One's here and one's there. So which num instances field will I be accessing? And this is tricky, right? Which field am I using? What I should do in C++ is use virtual inheritance. With virtual inheritance, I have my base class inherit both person. So I have my entity, person, and taxable entity, and then inherit musician. Without this, so on the left, it would be entity, taxable entity, person, and then musician. Right? So on your left, there are two instances of instance, and on the version on the right, there's only one base class. So there's only one num instances field in the musician type at the end. Clear? Okay. So Dylan language is sort of Lisp plus object orientation. I can define classes. So here I define a class choice widget, which has some methods, right, for the object code. And then some body end. And the same for menu. Menu inherits from choice widget. Pop-up mixin inherits from object. And pop-up menu inherits from both menu and pop-up mixin. So pop-up menu has multiple inheritance towards both classes. Right? Pop-up inherits from that one and inherits from that one. Right. So what is done in Dylan is linearization using breadth-first search. So it performs breadth-first search. Does this parent implement this method or this method, this class? If neither of these two classes implement the method that you're looking for, then it looks at the next level in your hierarchy. So it performs a breadth-first search to find methods that match your prototype for what you're trying to call. In C++, it's depth-first search. So it first looks at menu choice widget, and then looks an object to see if there's a method that matches. If neither happens, then backtracking, and it looks in pop-up mixing if there's a method there that matches my prototype. So you can either have breadth-first search or depth-first search in finding methods that match your prototypes. And only in a given layer is there overloading performed, right? So mixins. So a contract is very harsh, right? You need to completely specify all the methods in your contract, but you cannot have some little bit of implementation inside of your contract. So the idea of a mixin is that I have a partially completed class, which then is copy and paste in some other class, right? So I have a partial class. Parts of my mixin that are uncompleted are basically like the methods that I had in my contract, right? So a partially completed class that calls methods of the that should be completed later. So in Scala, for example, I have traits. A trait is a partially fulfilled contract. So basically, I'll copy paste into some other class. All right, so I have a trait, a partially fulfilled class, and can use it later here. So extend, I have a class iterator, which extends string iterator, and copy paste the methods from rich iterator into this class as well. So I have extends, which inherits, and with a mixin is copy and paste these methods also in inside of my class as well. Right? So this for each is copy pasted into my iterator class, so without having to do another level of inheritance. Generics. We already saw generics and templates in Ada, right? Where in Ada you had generic modules. Right? A module with some types left unspecified. And then at runtime, later you could instantiate a module with a given type. The same you can do with classes, of course, right? So you have generics or templates. There are two ways of implementing templates or generics, either by erasure or by type replacement. Type replacement is the more efficient. Right, so C++, Ada, Fortress, Scala all use type replacement. Java uses type erasure. Look at what the implications of these decisions are. Bit of C++. So in C++, I have my class as normal. Then I prefix my class with template type name T. So T is my generic type that should be instantiated later. I can instantiate this temporary by just as I've seen before, just like in Ada. What I can also do in C++ is have an int here, int v. And this v will be patched in later for this expression. So in Java, I could only write generic types. I can only make types more generic. I could not have expressions as part of what I've left out as unspecified in a class, in a generic. In C++, you can also have expressions left as generic. Right? So if I want to instantiate temp1, I just have to say temp1, instantiate that with int, comma, 6. That would work. Right? So a 6 will then be substituted for v, and we have static const int size equals 6. Right? That works. That brings us to template metaprogramming. So I can specify values as template arguments, for example, template, int n, so n is generic, and then specify my type, and this variable result will be initialized with Fibonacci n minus 1 plus Fibonacci n minus 2 for the result value. Right? And there are a number of base cases for the induction. Right? So I know Fibonacci 0 is 0 and Fibonacci 1 is 1. Right? And if here I say Fibonacci, instantiate type Fibonacci with value 10. Value 10 goes in here. It'll instantiate the Fibonacci with 10, Fibonacci 9, Fibonacci 8 will be dynamically instantiated. And I continue on instantiating with 9, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 we know, 0 we also know. And now we have at compile time completely evaluated Fibonacci. Right? So this is really very nice. We have compile time evaluations of entire methods. This is a step towards partial evaluation. So partial evaluation is try and substitute as much as you can at compile time, leaving only what you really is dynamic to be evaluated at runtime. So partial evaluation is do as much as you can at compile time, and leave the only what is left for actual evaluation. Java. In Java, we had generics by erasure. Erasure means throw away. Whenever you say that something is a generic type argument, so class list node t will be thrown out and replaced by object. So this will be object t list node next. The same here. Here I've not specified the type, so it will be list node object, list node object. So this line and this line are completely equal. The problem results here. Here I instantiate a list node with a B. So I know list node is a B. If list node is a B, then this must be a B as well, so B T. If T is of type B, B has a foo, so this method should be allowed to be invoked. Right? Once I've instantiated the generic. This does not work in Java because it's written by erasure. By erasure, it throws away all the type arguments and replaces it by object, and object does not have a foo method. Right? So to fix this, I need to say what the least expectation is for my type argument. So the least expectation for my type argument is that it must be at least an A. So my expectation for my type argument is whatever I instantiate my type argument with, it should be at least inherit from an A or implement an A. Then this function call works because A has a foo. So this foo invocation works. By erasure, what happens then is, if I have a type expectation, is then I replace all my generic types through my minimum expectation. So I replace all my T's by A's, and then it works. Introspection. Introspection, the idea of introspection is that I'd like to have for all my compile time information, a little bit of metadata that I can inspect at runtime. So I'd like to have at runtime information about what kind of methods and what kind of variables and what kind of types these variables have and what are the inners of these types are. I'd like to know all of these things at runtime. So what the compiler should do is whenever it compiles a class, it should also generate a meta class that specifies what it was in the original class. So if I have a class X with an integer field, then a meta class should be generated that says, I am the meta class of this other class, and this other class had a field called X of type int. Right? So in Java, there's a Java lang class instance for every normal class in my program. And I can then perform a lookup for given their string. So javalong class.forName javalong string gives me the meta class for string. And then I can look inside of C, I can iterate over all the methods and fields of the string class. All right? So Smalltalk, C Sharp, Java all have this meta information included. C++ is working on it with a working group, but they're not very far yet. There's only partial introspection in C++ currently. So what can I do with all this meta information? Let's look at the code here. I have a class introspect with a method foo with an integer argument. Then I do class C as class for name introspect, which gives me the meta class for introspect. So C specifies what the inners of introspect are. Then in my meta class, give me the meta method for method foo, where this method should have an integer argument. So I give the meta information for the integer type and the name of the method, and return me the meta method. So I now have the meta method in javalong reflect method. And I can invoke this method in foo using the meta method. Using the meta information, I can call the actual method then with the correct arguments, with the three. Note there is auto boxing going on here. Auto boxing is automatically convert from the object versions of primitive types towards their real primitive types. So this new integer 3 will be by unboxing converted from a class to an actual primitive type int. That's auto boxing and unboxing. Eiffel. Let's look at some example object-oriented languages. Eiffel. Eiffel was not built from taking some existing language like Pascal and add some object-oriented features. Started from scratch as a object-oriented language. So everything is, the start was to have everything object-oriented, but have things like int, float, double as expanded classes, like special classes, special objects. So they don't have all of this overhead they have from normal objects, but you can still call some methods on int and float. Right? I have generics. Arrays are generics. Right? There's some problem that arrays are. You can see arrays either as a primitive type. A primitive type construction into your language, or you can have arrays as a special kind of object with an indexing operator. Right? So arrays are generics for a given type, but implemented as a class. So arrays are classes. There's only dynamic binding, there's no static binding, so there's no way to get around the overhead of polymorphism. There's no modules, as we see in later, there's garbage collection as well. So here we have a stack class. A stack class is created by calling the make method. So you don't have special constructors with different syntax. You have only the normal syntax of methods, and make is the specially identified as used for the constructor. Have a number of features, the operations that are allowed on the class. Push, and then a precondition. So push is a method that has a V argument, so our generic V argument, and it's a require not full. And full is just a normal method over there. So full is called as before the actual push is made. Right? After this method is executed, there's an ensure. Ensure means post condition. So this whole line here is optionally invoked at the end of the method to see if your post condition holds. Right? Make is your constructor function. An int argument initializes some things. This is a little strange with exclamation mark, which means allocate a representation instance and then call the make method on that new instance. So this is like new. Right? So, Smalltalk. In Smalltalk, all the fields are untyped, but you don't have to specify any types. It's like a scripting language. Everything is an object. Everything is expensive. There's an automatic memory management. So my stack, new stack means allocate a new stack and send the reference that has been just created towards this myStack variable. MyStack is a variable, also an object, which accepts a new value. Right? Whenever you invoke a method, it's not called invoking a method, it's sending a message of a given type with a number of with a packet content, with a message content, towards this object which accepts the message, picks the function name to call from the method, the arguments, finds a matching method, and then actually performs the call. So visibility is all methods are public, there's no private or protected, and all the fields are private. So a little example, my stack allocates a new stack, sends the reference to the new value to the my stack object, which is a local object, which accepts this as a new value. Then to this my stack, I send a push message, with content 25. So this is the name of the method to call, and 25 is the value of the first argument. Here's a little more complex, right? I send the reserve on flight message to flight reservations with the with these arguments and that other argument as well. Right? So I have like named arguments, named parameters. So control flow, small talk, everything is an object. Control flows are objects as well. You don't have a while statement, you have a while object. And you have an if object, and so forth, and a switch object. So you send the switch while if object you send it a condition, and you send it a statement, which is also an object, and a while statement accepts these two statements and executes them. So in C++, if you would write if condition, execute. In Smalltalk, you would write, given a flight reservations object, send it a is empty message, right? And if that message is sent, evaluates, and then this flight reservations knows true or false as an object. This true or false object, we can send the if true message, right? And if it's the true object, then it'll pull the arguments of the if true and execute them by sending it onward. If it's the false object, it'll just throw away the rest of the message, right? So you have a Boolean object with instance true and instance false. The true object will take a message and execute it. The false object will just throw away the arguments, right? That's how it works. So C sharp. The problem with Java is that it was from Sun and not Microsoft, and therefore they built C sharp. So there was in C sharp, it's just like Java for the most part, with just small changes. What is new for C sharp is support for systems programming. In systems programming, you sometimes need to do unsafe stuff. Right? If you're trying to write a device driver, you sometimes need to twiddle bits with fixed addresses, right? So at this address, at this memory mapped I/O area, need to fiddle these bits. Java does not allow you to fiddle bits in random memory areas. So you need some way to have unsafe and safe code regions. Also added delegate support, we'll look at that in a bit. So pointer arithmetic is blatantly unsafe, right? But sometimes you need it because if you're trying to write a device driver, you need to do this. There's no way around it. So here we have an unsafe code block. I allocate an X and a Y on the stack. Then A is a pointer to an X. Then A++. One further is a Y, right? So then Z is indirect A. That should point to a Y, right? Am I correct or am I wrong? Ideas? Will this print 2? No, it does not print 2. For example, what can happen is the compiler is allowed to reorder variables on the stack. It can put the Y in a register, and so forth. So the Y may not even be in memory. So it's a little unsafe, but it works if you know how the compiler works. So C sharp, of course, the Microsoft people, they are also building the compiler and they know how the compiler works, and this ends up in the device driver. And then they add an optimization in the compiler and the Windows kernel crashes. So that happens. C sharp, but they also in C sharp there are function pointers. They're adding function pointers to Java as well, in like Java 9, I think. Like lambda functions.
Java
8, maybe. In 2015. So function pointers have a bad reputation, right? Because if you have a function point, it's not really object-oriented, and we want to do object-oriented programming. They're hard to make persistent. You cannot write a function point to disk, save that on a file, and then take that file to another machine, and then read the function pointer, and then invoke it, perhaps in another application. Right? That is a little tricky. So what we need to have some sort of object-oriented encapsulation of function pointers to make them more portable, more high-level. And that is a delegate. A delegate is a function pointer in an object-oriented format. So it contains name, return types, argument types, exception types, and so forth. Whatever you need for typing. So a little C-sharp code. I have a function foo, function zoo. Here I allocate a function pointer. Right? Where is my function pointer? Here. Here's my delegate int function pointer, x, y. Right? Here I instantiate my function pointer with argument foo. Right? So foo is a function, f1 is a function pointer to foo. And then I can, over f1, call that with these arguments. Right? That works. I can also create it from zoo, and so on. That works. Function pointers are, so delegates are a little more object-oriented, so they have toString and operators. So here I have f1 is a function pointer to foo, and here I say f1 plus is zoo. Plus equals means this delegate should also be able to call that one. So there's a list of function pointers in my delegate now. Whenever I call this f1, it's a the delegate is examined. It sees it's an array of function pointers, so it calls both of them. Right. So Scala. Scala has a little bit of everything. That was the idea of Scala. Just add everything that's a little bit in research and programming languages and add it to Scala. And see what happens when where people complain and that will throw out. That was the idea of Scala. So every 2 years, there's a committee that looks at Scala and says, nobody is using that feature that we added 2 years ago. Let's throw it out and make it a little bit different. And try and put it in the language. And let's in 2 years look at it again and see if people complained or not. That's the design idea of Scala. There's a little bit of functional programming in there. Scala is not functional. We are using Scala for programming, functional and parallel programming. Scala is, however, not functional. Scala has function pointers. If a language has function pointers, it does not make it functional. Ada has function pointers. Ada is not functional. Right? So when is a language functional? We'll talk about that in next week. In Scala, everything is an object. You have singleton objects. There's a little bit of support for XML, where you can have a sort of high-level interface to your XML code. A little bit of what they had in C# is this SQL-like syntax for querying data structures. We'll look at it in a later lecture as well. So singleton objects. The idea of a singleton object is that there should be only one instance of this object instead of a lot. But I don't want to write static all the time for my field. So if you don't want to write static for your fields, you can just make it a singleton object and then it will work. But it has the same semantics as making every field static. So there's not much gained, except for a little bit nicer syntax. So I have objects as well, so I have classes. I have a class where you can instantiate many of them, and then a singleton where you instantiate. There's automatically one instantiated. Call the constructor, have references. We can have either variables or values. Values are read-only, variables are mutable. Have function pointers. So here we have a function taking a function pointer argument. This is an anonymous function, right? So I have a prototype immediately followed by an implementation. So by following it by an implementation, you can take can easily create function implementations with shortcut anonymous functions. All right, so here I call printer over a function pointer. So again, there's a anonymous function effectively implemented here, right? So you can either say def printer is a function pointer, so print is a function pointer pointing to anonymous function, or you can look at it the other way around, it immediately implements the code. So you can look at it in both ways. Right. Scala, with Scala you have to implicitly mark which methods you override from your base class. So I have a base class with a foo, and here I explicitly must indicate that I actually really want to override this method. So I cannot accidentally override the method by hiding it. Pattern matching. We'll look at pattern matching again next week. So the idea of pattern matching is I have a number of instances and I want to perform some form of overloading over classes. So overloading over types. Then to select over the correct overloading, I then perform via pattern matching. So here I have a variable t, which is an x, 1, 2, 3. And then I want to perform, like overloading, the dynamic best matching case for this type argument. So it will compare x 876, 876 does not match, not good. KL3, 3 and 3, that matches. K and L are then unified to K equals 1, L equals 3, 2. So another example for type matching. The other example was more for value matching, right? This is more for type matching. So I have a number of classes which inherit from this tree class, this base class, this abstract class tree. And then here I perform type matching. I must match sum with T. So T is inspected via introspection to see what is the actual type. T is that a sum or a var or a const? If it's a sum, then go in that direction, var equals and so on. So I perform both type matching and value matching in the same step. As we'll see in functional languages, only do value matching instead of type, just of additionally doing type matching. As I said, Scala also has mixins. So a mixin was copy paste these methods into my code without doing the whole step of doing an inheritance. Right. So I have a trait collection. A trait was an incomplete class. With some methods abstract and some methods completed. Right, so it's a partially fulfilled contract. Some generics as well in Scala. We have a generic class, wrapper generic, with a generic type argument. This is then the constructor, right? So int type is then the constructor. So you don't write many constructors in a class, you just write one global constructor for the entire class. If you want to have multiple constructors, you need to write multiple classes, right? And then instantiate this wrapper with an int or a string. That works. Objective-C. Objective-C inherits from Smalltalk and C. So unlike C++ also inherits from C. There is this a lot stricter separation of specification and implementation. In Smalltalk, there is no such separation. In Smalltalk, you write one Smalltalk file, and that's it. You don't have a specification implementation differentiation. So it's a Smalltalk-like syntax for method calls, but you can also use the normal C-like method invocation. Let's look at this. Here I have a cure class. So the interface cure inherits from object and has a number of private fields. And then here come the methods of my new class. If I have a minus, so minus, 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 it's an instance method. And when I write plus, it's like a static method in Java. So plus means static, minus means no static. And then have a return type, and then void, push, one argument, and also another argument. It's a little bit wordy, right? You have to write this and all, and also if you have many arguments. It's a lot of work. There's also the ID type. ID is like a generic type, so like a dynamic type, which so an untyped data declaration or untyped variable. We look at the ID in a bit. But there's then the implementation, or the specification for the interface, and then the implementation in a separate file. So implementation and declaration are separate. It's just as you have in Smalltalk, you send messages, right? So send the push message to self with the V1 argument, right? So the message with V1 as content and push as its name to the self object. And self then accepts the message. So object instantiation. Cure is a class. I send the alloc method to the class, which generates me a new instance. And then I send to the new instance the initial the init method to actually initialize the class. So first allocate memory and then initialize it. So one method and then another to the result. And so forth. I have this ID, so I don't have to think about types. ID is like a generic type, generic variables. I don't have to think about what kind of type it is. It's like var in or auto in C++. Right, I can send this push message to this generic dynamic value, to this dynamic value, and in Q, I don't know if Q is if you type ID. I don't have no idea if it has a push method. So at runtime, it's examined if in this Q object there is a push method. So internally, it looks at all the methods. If are you a push? Are you a push? Are you a push? Yes. Do you have the correct arguments? Yes. Invoke. So at runtime, there is a lot of string comparison going on to find the correct method to call. Right? You can do a little bit of optimization here by doing a little bit of hashing and a little bit of pre-processing, a little bit of compiler analysis. But in the end, if you don't know, then you have to do a runtime analysis to find what kind of methods there are in the object. Q was also was a dynamic type, right? You don't know what Q has for methods, right? But you can have, there are operands for seeing if something is a member of, for introspection. So introspection is via is member of. Is Q a member of this Qer class? Right? Or is Q a kind of Qer class? Right? So is member of? Are you a direct instance? Or are you something that inherits from Qer? Or are you implementing the push methods? So how this works is response to is sent to Q with argument at selector with a string push. And this method is introspected to see if this object implements the push method. If yes, then it'll return yes, and yes equals yes, then it'll print this message. So you can dynamically examine an object to see if it implements a given method before you call it. If you call if you have some dynamic variable and you call a method that it does not implement, you get an exception. Right? Posers. The idea of posers is that sometimes I want to have a bug fix. Right? I create a program, and after a while I notice that my program has a bug. Then I want to dynamically update my program while the program is running. So while my program is running, I want to exchange one class for another class to remove the buggy class and to insert the correct class at runtime. That's what I want to do. So this will start over here, right? Qer alloc init This allocates and then initializes a queue. I send a push message to queue and dump to print it out. Then I say queue poser. I send the queue poser class, the pose as method, saying that queue poser should pose as the queuer class. So now when I instantiate a queue class, I'll instantiate a queue poser class instead. So I've exchanged the queue class by the queue poser class at runtime. So I change my class hierarchy. That is what I'm doing. If I'm calling queue dump, yeah, queue was already with this old class hierarchy, so I can't do anything there. So queue still calls queuer dump. But for the new classes, here I sent queuer the alloc message, but queuer was posed by this queue poser. So this alloc message will be sent to the queue poser class instead, right? So anything queue is replaced by queue poser after a little bit. And that's the end for the day.